Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Today our guest is no guest at all. Richard and I will be answering your questions that you've submitted at gamblingwithanedge.com and gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com, among other places. We thank you for sending them.
I just want to say that don't be confused about the questions we solicited for hosts, which we've gotten loads and loads of response. These are questions for us, but the host will be coming. Actually, we may have more than one host. We have several on the line. Anyway, I just wanted to clarify that.
All right. The first question involves a husband and wife playing on one video poker card to maximize their chances to get to a higher level. Wants to know if it's okay. The answer is, it depends on the casino. Some casinos have no problem at all with this. Others do. If you want to do this, you might ask at the booth if it's okay to have a joint account. If you're both on the same account, then that would be fine. If they say that's not allowed, then you have to make a decision as to whether or not you plan to risk it. If you're playing for quarters and never get W2Gs, you'll likely get away with it. If you're a high-limit player with lots of W2Gs, you won't. Even if they don't officially allow it, playing side-by-side with you is usually accepted, no matter who gets the W2G.
Also, if you are a known loser with a big lifetime minus on your account, all rules are different, so you can probably get away with that with no problem.
All right. Richard, here's a question for you. A resident of Canada with a seven-figure bankroll, I don't know if he means Canadian dollars or
not American. That big a difference.
A seven-figure bankroll earned from hole carding. He wants to know if it's possible to earn $200,000 a year gambling online, playing 50 hours a week.
So when he says gambling online, I'm going to guess that he means playing online at casinos as opposed to sports betting or poker or some combination. Obviously, if you're doing those two things, one or both of those two things along with your online casino gambling, your results are going to vary depending on how skilled you are at those two activities. If you're talking about just online casinos, the answer is really, I have no idea. In Canada, there are a lot more online casinos that are available to you than there would be if you were living in the United States. My suspicion is that, yes, it's possible, but if you're it also depends on how sharp you are about taking advantage of these things. It's not quite as easy as, you know, go get a bonus and grind it out for small stakes playing blackjack. There are a lot of kind of tricks and things that you have to learn over time. And if you have a network of other people that are playing, that's going to be helpful. So is it possible? I suspect that it is, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay. Next question. This is for you, Richard. And I actually have no idea what the guy's talking about.
I love those questions.
He wants to know whether a big player moving a shoe or continual shuffle machine in order to improve game quality is fair game. He ran into a team that does this, although their stakes aren't above $200 or $400. It was surprising to me that they would slightly move the shoe sometimes every hand in order to make an unplayable game playable or to improve a partial info game.
I don't see anything wrong with that at all. We have done many, many things to try to improve games in the past. If I thought I could get away with that, I would certainly give it a try. I'm kind of surprised, actually, that they just do this routinely without any problems, because, like, if I was the dealer, I would go, hey, don't touch my shoe. You know what I mean? But if you're tipping enough, the dealer probably isn't going to care. And if you're playing that kind of game, your edge is big enough where you can afford to be tipping the dealer. So, yeah, I mean, I would certainly give it a try, and, you know, until they tell you to stop.
Can you give us a hint as to what kind of information you would gain out of this?
Well, without giving away too much, I would say that sometimes the position of the shoe and the position of the player's bets at first base make things very crowded over there. And it sometimes makes it more difficult for the dealer to get the cards out of the shoe, which sometimes can create errors on the dealer's part.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Another player, he made a trip to Las Vegas, and he was cashing out $5,000 chips at one casino. Actually, it was probably $5,000 in chips. They asked for ID. Because he was counting cards, I excused that I'm a foreigner and left my passport in the hotel room. They let me go, but said next time I needed to show ID. So my question is it really required by law to show ID when you cash out for $5,000, or is it just a bluff?
No, it's not required by law, but the casino has all these rules with the U.S. government, with FinCEN, about reporting requirements, and a lot of casinos require it. And it's their rule, but it's not a law. Now, the people who work in the casino, they may not know that. You know, a lot of times they'll say it's the law, even when it's not. So at $10,000, they are required to fill out a cash transaction report. But again, it is not the law, as I understand it. I'm not a lawyer. It is not the law that you have to show them ID. But they are required, they have to no longer give you deal to you. If you're buying in at a table and you go in over $10,000, my understanding is if you refuse to show ID, they have to tell you to leave. But my understanding is that it is not the law that you have to show the ID. Now, for practical purposes, you should never, if you don't want to show ID, you should never get close to $10,000 in buy-ins. All the casinos are going to ask you for ID at over, well, some of them are $2,500. Most of them are $2,500. Some of them are less. And some of them are bigger sticklers about it than others. So it's not the law. But if you say, no, I'm not going to show ID, they can just say, well, we're not going to cash out your chips. And now you can call the gaming commission or the gaming control. Gaming control will come out. And the first thing they'll say is they need to see your ID. And as soon as they have it, they're going to tell the casino who you are. So for practical purposes, if you're cashing out that much, you're going to probably end up having to show ID. Indian casinos, your mileage may vary.
In video poker, there's one casino here in Vegas, the Silverton, that makes you show ID if you have a ticket of $1,200 or more. They have machines on the regular part of the floor. If you have like $1,000 in credit and you get a $400 jackpot, it will spit you out a $400 ticket. But in the high limit room, it will go up to $3,000. So if you play in the high limit room, it's very possible to get tickets of $1,200 or more. And they require you showing ID to cash them. Now, showing ID in video poker, especially if you play in high limit rooms, is not that big of a deal because you get W2Gs, and W2Gs definitely by law require it. And if you're a video poker player getting W2Gs, you have bit that bullet and you accept that you have to give up your ID.
But yeah, and there are some casinos that are so paranoid about card counters and things that they will not let you play blackjack. They will not let you buy in at a table for more than $1,000 unless you have a player's card. And if you get to $1,000 and don't have a player's card, you can't play anymore. So, yeah, I mean, casinos can basically do what they want.
All right. New question. This is a video poker question. Someone who has a gambling addiction wants to know if it's possible to learn to play video poker perfectly, therefore obtaining an edge, and so beat the addiction by winning. The addiction's only a problem if you lose. My answer to that is I want no part of this. I do not wish to be responsible for somebody falling off the wagon, so to speak, because of any recommendation I make. For this reason, I recommend that if you have a gambling addiction, stay away from gambling.
Yeah, you know, that question has puzzled me for a long time because I have known very few, but a few people who were able to win at a certain game but have a gambling addiction where they would lose their money at other forms of gambling. And it always seemed so strange to me. And when I interviewed Billy Walters in my book, he said he was a total degenerate. I mean, he lost millions of dollars gambling before he woke up one day and realized that, you know, he was blowing all this money. Now, in his case, he was able to stop the non-winning play. But some people aren't able to do that. Josh Axelrad, in his book, Repeat Until Rich, was on a, you know, very large blackjack team, won a lot of money playing blackjack. But in the book, he talks about his addiction to online poker, where he lost all his money. So, you know, the brain is a very complicated and strange thing. But yeah, I would not recommend taking up video poker if you have a gambling addiction problem.
It's called the crack cocaine of gambling for some reason.
Yeah.
Another video poker question. Player was playing quarter, 10 play, double-double bonus, and was dealt 4-4-4-4 queen. Now, double-double bonus is a game where if you're dealt 4-4, if you get 4-4s, and the fifth card is a 5 through a king, it pays you $100, 400 coins. So on a 10 play, that means $1,000. If the fifth card is a 2-3-4, well, a 2-3 or an ace, then you get $200. So if you get two or more of these kickers in 10 play, which is normal, the average is about two or three, then you also get a W2G. So you can take the guaranteed $1,000 by holding the queen so you cannot get a kicker, or you can risk it and maybe get a W2G if you get two or more of the kickers. Who wants to know what it should do? Now, in my case, I would always make the correct play, get the kickers. I get lots and lots of W2Gs in a year and file as a professional gambler. And it's not a it's not an issue for me. However, if you get very few, W2Gs are taxable. And the new tax law makes them more taxable than they were before. And we'll talk about it more next time we have Russell Fox on the show. And if that's an issue for you, you probably shouldn't be playing quarter, 10 play, double-double bonus. There's a number of ways you can get W2Gs from that game. And so if getting W2Gs is a big issue for you, and you're making all the plays so you don't get it, you're giving up quite a bit of EV. So probably shouldn't be playing that game.
Yeah, they did make it much worse for people who are gambling but not filing as professional gamblers. Things are getting a lot worse, and I think we're going to have a guest post coming up fairly soon about that issue.
Good. Okay, here's a question for you, Richard. Now, you used to be a casino dealer. Do you think that helped you become an AP?
Yeah, tremendously. Oh. Well, it did a number of things, but first of all, it gives you experience with what is actually going on in the pit and going on with the dealers, but more so what's going on in the pit. So when you're counting cards, it's very easy to feel like everybody in the casino knows what you're doing. They're all looking at you and, you know, they're just ready to call the security goons. And once you've worked on the other side, you realize that every time the boss looks over, you know, he it may have the majority of the time, it has absolutely nothing to do with you. And when two bosses are looking over and they're talking, well, they're probably talking about, are you betting on the game tonight? Or did you see that girl on table 12? Or that table needs more chips. The same thing when they get on the phone. It doesn't mean they're calling anybody about you. It might be this table needs cocktails, or did you see the girl on table 12? And the other thing that makes people paranoid is when the dealer comes off the game and he goes over and starts talking to the boss. And that easily can be, can I get, you know, next Thursday off? Or did you see the girl on table 12? You'll notice a pattern in the discussion. There's actually a lot more talk about sports betting than I'm letting on here. But those are the two major topics of discussion between the pit bosses and the dealers. So it alleviates a lot of that. Another thing, people get very paranoid. Some new suit shows up in the pit and starts talking to the boss and they're looking at you. Well, a lot of times that turns out to be a host, right? So anyway, working on the other side, it just gives you a much better idea. It really cuts down on the amount of paranoia on the part of the player. The other thing it does is most people in the pit and dealers have terrible poker faces. So when something is going on, they may be trying to hide it, but it just seems really obvious to me most of the time. And I really attribute that to the fact that I've never been back-roomed, is that in many cases, I see the heat before it actually comes down, and I'm able to just leave and be out the door before anything happens.
If somebody wanted to become an AP, would you recommend they become a casino dealer for a couple years first?
Well, that's an awful lot of time to put in, to further an AP career. But if you're young and you need to build a bankroll and need to get a job anyway, yeah, I think it could be a great job to start out to help build your bankroll and to practice. I mean, that was the other thing that it helped me with. Well, it helped me in some other ways. So one is I had 8 hours a day to practice counting cards and shuffle tracking and things like that. The other thing that it helped me enormously was I worked in a casino where every card counter in the world showed up because our game was so good. We had single deck, stand on soft 17. The game was basically break even off the top. So everybody came to that casino. It was called the Castaways. It's where the Mirage is today. So I met tons of card counters, and it extended my network to lots of people. And having a network is tremendously important, whether it's in video poker or in blackjack. So I got to meet all these people and eventually join teams because of that, because of people I met. So, yeah, I kind of had a reputation because when people would come in and count cards, I would start talking to them about counting cards, right? And which would kind of freak them out.
I'll bet.
Yeah, because they weren't used to a dealer doing that. But it was clear I wasn't giving them heat. I was obviously another player, and we would talk about counting cards. And I would deal them a really good game. And so then people would tell their friends, hey, go play against this dealer without telling them anything else, so that it would freak their friends out when they went in and played against me. So, so as I say, it helped a lot because, I met lots of people that way.
All right. We're going to do commercials a little bit earlier today than we usually do. And then after the commercials, we're going in a slightly different direction. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. The promotion in June is the $500,000 guaranteed big spin and win. Every Thursday in June at 8:15, 25 winners will get to spin the wheel. Wheel amounts are $2,000 in free play. And on the wheel of 30, there are 15 of those. You can hit guaranteed $5,000 in cash. There are 13 of those, and there's one 10,000 and one 25,000. You can do the math, but the average is pretty high. If everything goes according to average, they will give out less than 400,000. And they've guaranteed to give out 500. What this means is that the last week they will keep calling five people at a time until they reach 500,000 or more. There will be a lot more people called on June 28th, but also a lot more people trying to get it. So I don't know if the odds will be any better or not, but Bonnie and I are going to be there. You can earn up to 1,600 entries a day, where you get one entry per video poker dollar and four entries for every slot dollar in. The promotion day is midnight to midnight, and you may earn entries after 9 p.m. on Thursdays. So you can go like 11 o'clock at night, earn your tickets before midnight, and then do it after midnight. Tickets must be activated on Thursdays at any machine between 4 and 8 p.m. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Bonus Streak Ultimate X. This is a 10 coin per line version of Ultimate X. Like every Ultimate X games, you earn multipliers on this hand to be played off next hand. Compared to regular Ultimate X, the multipliers are much harder to get. You need three of a kind rather than just a pair of jacks. But when you get the multipliers, you get them for several hands in a row. I have not seen strategies for this game posted, so you'll have to work it out for yourself. All right.
Wait a minute. Before we go on, yes. I wanted to clarify something about that South Point. You said you can get tickets after 9 o'clock on Thursdays. Does that mean you can get double tickets on Thursdays? In the morning and then again after 9 o'clock?
Yes. They want to give people a reason to stick around after the drawing. And so once they get them to play, they frequently will pay more than that. So there's a three-hour window between approximately 9 p.m. and midnight on Thursday nights, in addition to the earlier. All right. My career started out as a backgammon player. I spent several thousand hours over more than 15 years playing and studying the game. I became a decent player, but not great. I believe that going through that helped me become a expert gambler in video poker. The games are very, very different, but the experience I went through helped me. Now, I met Richard playing video poker, playing backgammon. So what I want to talk about is how that experience in backgammon specifically, but in one game, helped on others. And so the getting started, the primary way to get better at any video poker or any gambling game is to study. At backgammon at the time, there were no computer programs. There are today. But there were a few books, some better than others. We played propositions. Now, what a proposition is you set up the board in a particular but unusual way, and then you start the game from there and you play it out. And it could be who was the favorite. It could be if it's a double or a take or a pass. It could be you could offer odds, all kinds of things.
One play better than the other play. And usually these propositions started from some position that actually happened in a game, and there was an argument about what the right thing to do.
Yeah, and when you play them 100 times or 200 times, and you keep notes or you have a good memory, you become a better player. Now, with today's computer programs, you can get the answer to these things essentially instantly. But back then, that's the way you got better. And the players who played props the most got to be better faster. Did you play propositions, Richard?
Oh, yeah. I played a lot of propositions, not so much to get better, but usually to make money because...
So as a hustle, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah.
You had a strong opinion about which side is better.
Well, usually I was playing these propositions only when I knew that one side was better than the other. And you know, my approach to learning anything, whether it was backgammon or blackjack or poker or whatever, was to first go read whatever books I could find on the subject and then to go seek out the best players I could find and try to learn from them. And when I say learn from them, that may just mean, you know, playing against them or playing in – you can play backgammon with more than two people. It's called chouette. So there'd be – and chouettes are particularly good because often the players are allowed to consult. Chouette means one player is playing against all the rest. And if the guy who is the single player loses, then the guy who beat him moves into the box, it's called, and the next player moves up the rotation as the captain for the other team. But the players talk about what's the best move and whether they should turn the doubling cube or not. And so it's a really good way to learn if you're playing with better players than you are. It's a really good way to make money if you're playing with worse players than you are. So anyway, that was my approach. And the same thing in blackjack. I went and got every book I could find. I read the books, and then I sought out better players. And again, we goes back to what I was saying earlier about having a network. And so in backgammon, it's a pretty tightly knit community. I go to a backgammon tournament today, and I still see guys that I used to see at tournaments 35 years ago. And that community, you know, helps you. So, and it ended up helping in blackjack as well, because sometimes I would meet people through backgammon that I ended up doing things with, and through backgammon that I ended up doing things in blackjack or, you know.
On this network, how often did you discuss things with other backgammon players? You're not gambling with them. You're just talking about why this move is better than another.
Whoa. A lot. I used to hang out in the Cavendish Bridge Club in Chicago. There were two clubs, the Cavendish and the Cavendish North. And I was at the Cavendish North 8 to 10 hours a day. I mean, when I was in college, I was either at class or I was at the club. And so it was a bridge club, but they also had backgammon. And the bridge players and some of the options traders in Chicago would come hang out there. They also had gin rummy and whatever people wanted to play, basically. So there were two very strong chess masters that had given up chess and had taken up backgammon. And they were the strongest backgammon players in the club. And often we would sit around and...
Was Bill Kennedy one of them? Or was he...
No, Bill Kennedy lived in San Francisco, as far as I know.
And Howard Markowitz, was he there at the time?
Howard Markowitz, yes. Later in... Howard, I first met... Howard is a very strong player today. And Howard was playing in these weekly tournaments. I met him at the weekly tournaments that were like buy-in for $20 and, you know, the winner gets 150 or something like that. So, but he at the beginning, he wasn't down at the Cavendish so much. But anyway, the strong players would discuss positions all the time because there are a lot of very strong egos in backgammon and, you know, people think they're right about certain things. So a position would come up, and then after the chouette, when the fish were gone, the strong players would sit around and try to break down that position and argue about it and play it out and, you know, figure out really what was the better play.
Yeah, my play was done at the Cavendish West, which was in the West Hollywood area of Los Angeles, which is where I met Richard sometime later. But before we get to Richard, a critical part of all successful gambling is playing when you have the advantage. So that involves, now in video poker, it's easy to know that one game is 99.54 or in the slot club pays 0.3125 and the mailers are blah, 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 blah. Those kind of things are relatively easy to figure out. At backgammon, you have to figure out your relative skill levels between you and the other guy. If you're the, as they say, if you're the 10th best player in the world and you regularly play the top five best players in the world, you're a great player, but you're going to lose. So now, if I know that you are a better player than me, I'm probably not going to play you very much because I know that it's very expensive. So when I first met Richard, I had no idea he was a better player than me. He seemed to be just an average kind of a guy.
That was my strength. My superpower was people thought I looked hopeless.
And so I lost quite a bit of money to this hopeless player, and I could not figure out how he did it. Now, so my question to you, Richard, is, was it an accident that you looked hopeless, or was that an intentional strategy that you cultivated?
I never understood. I never got any respect. I don't know why. Maybe it's the way I look. I don't know. But I just never got any respect. And there were guys who were total fish that would sit down and play with me that would not go near any of the other good players in the club. I mean, and there were players that I was better than that they wouldn't play against, you know, but they would, you know, play with me. And it used to infuriate my friends who were the good players because, we had a rule in the club that all chouettes were open, right? So if there was a chouette going on, anybody could walk in. Paul McGrill, he got to join if he wanted to play. But if you were playing just heads up, well, that's, you can't just make people form a chouette. So I'd be playing some guy that was just terrible, and my friend would come in and say, do you want to make this a chouette? And the guy would say, no, we're playing heads up. And then he leaned over to me and he goes, we don't want those hustlers in our game. You know? So, yeah, I don't know. As I say, it worked for me. But one of the things that, and this is going to sound really simple, but an important part of gambling is expected value. Like, what is your edge, right? And and in backgammon, you have to learn that. First of all, you have to learn about the concept, and then you have to learn how to apply it. So to just take a very simple example, there's a one-roll position in backgammon where the game's going to be over, and there are 36 combinations in the dice, and 19 times you would win and 17 times you would lose.
It's right? A 5-2.
Right. So, you know, that means that out of 36 times, you're going to win two extra times or 1/18, right? So your expected value is 1/18. So if you got to this position and you wanted to make a settlement, which this happened a lot, people wanted to make settlements to avoid variance. In this case, your expected value is 1/18. So if you happen to be playing for $18 a point, your equity or your expected value is $1, right? Now, of course, you're going to say, I'll settle for two. Anytime you can get some edge, that's what settlements were all about. And there were guys who just really tried to make their money on settlements by robbing people in the settlements, especially if the cube got high because people didn't want to take big swings. So anyway, that was something really basic and fundamental, but that's where I learned it. You know, we didn't have any of this in basic math class in high school, although I think it should be taught.
Probability and stuff and figuring out settlements.
Yeah, I mean, because then you can start to look at things like insurance and see what it's really costing you, right? Like, you know, here's what it's going to cost for your car insurance, but the odds of you actually having an accident. I mean, this is an obviously much more complicated question, but you start to realize how the insurance company is making money by just betting on whether you're going to have a car accident or not and taking a big profit on it. So that was a tremendously important lesson to learn, which I got there.
Another lesson related to that. So, like, going to be the last play of the game. This is the next to last play. Your checkers are on the 5 and the 3, and you have an ace to play. So after what Richard just said, you knew know that you go from the 3 to the 2. So 5-2, you have a slight edge over the your opponent to roll off in one shake, or you could make it 4-3, which you're a slight underdog. Sometimes your opponent, you'll see them make the 4-3, and you go in your mind, you know, that guy's an idiot, doesn't know the first thing. And then on the very next shake, he will roll a 4-3, which is the one shake where his bad play gets rewarded and the smarter play would have been punished. And you see these things all the time.
So you learn that life is not fair.
Life is not fair. And
I mean, really the thing that backgammon teaches you is human nature. And I think this happens in poker as well. People's real character gets revealed when they're gambling.
Especially when they're losing.
Yes, especially when they're losing. And I had a roommate, this chess master that ended up moving out here to Las Vegas.
I think I know who that is.
Yeah. And I remember we were roommates at the time, and he was really one of the strongest players in the country. And he had been at the backgammon club here in Vegas, and I had gone home, and he was playing a guy who was a total fish. I mean, the guy had no chance to win, right? And he comes home, and he slams the door, and he kicks his shoe off, and the shoe flies across the room and bounces off the wall. And I said, oh my God, what happened? And he said, I only won 3 points. right? So he had won, but he was so pissed off because he should have won maybe 30 points, But, yeah, so that you really learn about, and actually that ended up being why I gave up backgammon, was because when you win money from the casino, it's faceless and you don't have to deal with any of the human foibles. But in backgammon, to really make money at it, you have to play against people who are degenerates. Those are the ones you're going to make the most money from. And it just became kind of not worth it to me. Really sort of distasteful to kind of take advantage and grind those people out of their money. So
That was a problem. There was a face to the loser, and sometimes when they lost, it really, really hurt. Sometimes they would bring their wives or girlfriends along to watch them lose, and the wife, would be sitting there, there went my washing machine, and so that was tough. Another human element in backgammon that was a big factor for me is there are a lot of jerks who are gambling. A lot of people, really bright people, but don't play well with others. Whatever bad habits. The poker example of this would be Mike Mattisau, who is famous for, or even Phil Hellmuth, who are different, but they will do things that would not do in polite company.
Oh, yeah, and exactly the Phil Hellmuth characters who get up and like, you're such an idiot, you play so bad, on and on and on. Yeah, and that was another reason I gave up.
So for that reason, I didn't take up live poker. There's a lot of, if you get good at backgammon, I mean, I have the brain and stuff that I could be good at live poker if that's where I wanted to apply myself. But there are all these people with these bad social habits that you have to play with.
Yeah, and some of them don't bathe.
And in video poker, for the most part, you're dealing with a machine. And there is some human interaction, but not nearly as much.
Well, but isn't that the bad part of video poker? Is the guy who comes and sits next to you and starts smoking or has BO or talks incessantly? It's always the people.
Well, yeah, there is that, but it's a much lesser problem in video poker than it is in live poker.
Sure.
Because those same people come and play live poker, and there's more of them.
In video poker, you can go out at midnight and play in the middle of the night when there are a lot less people around. And
you can, and I do.
Yeah.
Another thing that I learned about from backgammon is about winning streaks and losing streaks. Everybody, even the good players, had losing streaks, but they always bounced back from them. The losing players had winning streaks, but they always ended up giving it all back.
Well, and how not to go on tilt. I mean, that was, I think that was another one of my strengths, was I was pretty unflappable when I was losing. And if it really did start to affect me, I knew enough to just stop playing, just get up from the table. And that's a really important lesson.
It is. And especially if you're losing to a hopeless player.
Yeah.
That you have to get up from the table. But staying at the table, you know, is money in the bank, because this guy is terrible. But if you're... if you're going on tilt.
Yeah. And another thing, going back to when I was talking earlier about making settlements, I really learned how risk averse people were. Guys with millions of dollars that, you know, didn't want, the cube was on 16 and were playing for $10 a point, so they don't want to lose $160. I mean, the money would be totally inconsequential to them, but relative to their score on the sheet, they didn't want to take a 16-point swing, and so they would give up something in a settlement, even when they knew they were taking the worst of it, which was really surprising to me. But we see it all the time in blackjack or in gambling, is people just, you know, they hate losing, so they will that's why people think it's right to insure a blackjack. You know, to because they hate the idea of not getting paid on if they push, you know. And the other thing that I found, where, again, sharp gamblers were willing to knowingly take the worst of it. We had a guest on the show a couple of years ago, Kent Golding.
Uh-huh.
And I remember he would
come to... Very, very good player.
Very, very good player, yes. And he would come to backgammon tournaments. It might have been him and Nack Ballard. There were two of them. I think they were partners in crime. And he had a $500 bill and a $1,000 bill. And he would offer people, they could roll, I don't remember exactly what it was. You could roll three dice and you had to roll three of a kind, or maybe a specific three of a kind, to win the, you know, either the $500 or the $1,000 bill. He had different propositions where it was very clear to everybody in the room that they had, you know, between a 10 and 20% edge. But guys loved the idea of being able to, you know, risk a dollar or whatever it was, $2, to win 500 or win 1,000. I mean, they're the same people, I guess, who would buy lottery tickets or play the slot machines. But these guys knew how to figure out the equity, and yet they would still do it because it looked fun to them. So.
Yeah, even like today, I was playing earlier this week on an Ultimate X game at South Point, and the guy next to me was just moaning and groaning on every 5 minutes that whenever he was dealt a three of a kind and he didn't get a four of a kind, he's claiming the game is rigged, and when he does get a four of a kind, is now he has a low multiplier, and so just moaning and groaning, and you get that a lot in backgammon, and
poker and all gambling, yeah.
I've pretty much outgrown that, but apparently some people never will.
Yeah, I mean, how many times have you heard from a blackjack player about how the count was through the roof and the, you know, the dealer hit a 16 and caught a 5, you know? Well, yeah, happens every day, all the time. I mean, it's not an interesting story anymore. Yeah, you lost some money, okay.
Yeah, they. You're a terrible audience, Richard.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm really not a sympathetic shoulder for those stories.
Another thing I learned is you don't change your play based on momentary results. Like, there's a right play, and on some games you figure it out, even though you keep losing making that play over and over again. If you're convinced it's the right play, keep doing it. Like in video poker, the difference between a four flush and a low pair, in most games, it's right to hold the four to the flush. But there are days that those flushes just don't come in. So people go, well, hell, as long as they're not coming in, I'm going to start holding the pair, which is a terrible thing to do, but you do it all the time. You see it all the time. So
Yeah, you have to believe in the math. If you don't believe in the math, you shouldn't be trying to gamble with an edge. I mean, you just shouldn't.
That's it. All right.
Actually, this reminds me of, I mean, some people who are trying to gamble with an edge, they kind of only, they don't fully believe in the math. You know what I mean? Like, they think they know, they understand what the edge is, but they just don't fully believe. And I know a guy who thought he had a particular edge on something. And he said, when this happens, you know, on this specific machine, I go in and I martingale it, right, until it hits. I was like, well, if you have an edge, why are you martingaling it, right? You have an edge, so just bet the max. What's the point of the martingale? So anyway, that's what I mean by they don't really fully get it.
And that's an interesting point of if you were never good at math and you'd like to be an advantage gambler, you're not going to make it.
Yeah.
Which is the sad but true.
Actually, I wouldn't say that. You can be bad at math, but as long as you believe that it's true and are willing to always follow it, you'll be okay. Because I do know guys who got into both video poker and blackjack who really didn't understand the math, but they understood they were supposed to follow the rules. And if they followed the rules, they were doing the right thing.
Okay. And part of it is my perspective comes from playing as a solo player. So I have to figure out whether this particular game at this particular casino with this particular slot club and promotion and mailer situation is a good play. If I had teammates and I just told them, go play that one, I figured it out, it's
right.
Good. Then even if the teammate was not capable of figuring out himself, they would be fine.
And I think there are quite a few of those players out there.
Yeah, that's
you know, they have
true.
Very good social skills, and so they get told, go play that machine when it's at this number or whatever.
Yeah, it's like on some of the games that you play, Richard, with temporary partners, it's often one of the temporary partners who figured out the strategy to beat it and the math, using the math and stuff. So it wasn't you who did that.
Right.
But you were a key part of the team because of other things you brought to the team.
Right. Yep.
So I will rephrase. So I guess you don't have to be a math genius. Just become partners with someone who is. Now, before the show started today, Richard told me about this article that he read about the worst places to live in the United States. And what was surprising to me is that Las Vegas came out like the third worst.
Fourth, yeah.
Fourth worst place, meaning it's terrible, which to me just has to be wrong.
Well, and it turned out it was wrong.
So what happened?
It was one of the, I fell for a clickbait article. It turned out that the one reason that they listed Las Vegas as so bad was because of the crime rate. And it turned out that they were only looking at the city of Las Vegas proper, which is a very, very small part of the Las Vegas Valley.
Downtown near Fremont Street.
Downtown near Fremont Street, right. And it was totally misleading and kind of massaging the facts in the wrong way. So, because I looked at it and I was like, man, that's strange. I love living here. And
yeah,
it doesn't seem
too.
Like the crime rate is that bad, you know. But I remember, you know, when Billy Walters got the Bally High Golf Course, he got a real sweetheart deal on the land, you know, south of Mandalay Bay to build that golf course. And one of the conditions was that people who lived in Las Vegas could, I forget, play cheaply or really free. I mean, really cheaply or free or something like that. And then it turned out he was like, well, you know, no, it's the city of Las Vegas. So it limited it to basically almost no one who lived down by Fremont Street plays golf. So, yeah, anyway. So Vegas is a great place to live. Don't listen to the to that article.
All right. And on the night we're doing this is our sports team, the Vegas Knights, are playing an elimination game. They could actually be out of the Stanley Cup Finals. It's been a hell of a run just to get there. And tonight they're playing, and the town is optimistic they're going to come back. But right now Washington has a pretty big lead on them.
Yeah.
All right. So, Richard, thank you. In the future, go ahead and keep sending us these questions, because we like having these shows. We like answering
questions. And we always have trouble finding guests.
That too. So thank you, Richard. Go out and hit a royal flush, everybody. Good day.